Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thank you for listening to Sound Optometry. Just a reminder that you will no longer receive a CPD point by listening to this episode of the podcast. But if you subscribe and listen to the most recent episodes of Sound Optometry, you can gain CPD points. I hope you enjoy this episode of Sound Optometry. Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Welcome to Sound Optometry, the podcast from Docket that provides high-quality, continuing professional development for all GOC-registered optometrists. With case studies and in-depth conversations, each month we explore the topics that matter the most to us optometrists. You can gain one CPD point by listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on our website, docket.info. On Sound Optometry, we often talk about the exciting treatments that are on the horizon in eye care. As practitioners, we need to keep our knowledge up to date so that we can keep our patients informed. In this episode, we'll be discussing a development that really gives us something to be most excited about, ocular gene therapy. Whilst eye problems that arise from the malfunction of a single gene are thankfully rare, they often have a devastating impact. Gene therapies have been shown to improve the sight in people that have a rare inherited disease. But more than 350 eye conditions have some genetic component. So researchers are investigating whether gene therapies could also help people with those more common conditions that involve malfunctions in multiple genes. A particularly intriguing example is AMD, which affects hundreds of thousands of people in the UK. An injection that could preserve a patient's central vision would be truly remarkable. Trials are ongoing all over the world for ocular gene therapies, and one such drug is already available in clinics here in the UK for a certain type of an inherited retinal dystrophy.
Just about a month or two after I treated her, it was Guy Fawkes Night, and they saw fireworks for the first time, and her mum was like, "Oh!"
That's Rob Henderson, a consultant paediatric ophthalmologist and vitreoretinal surgeon at Great Ormond Street Hospital. He was instrumental in bringing that gene therapy into clinical practice.
It's very rewarding. It's one of the few treatments that I can honestly think of where you are restoring function and giving something that a child or an adult has possibly never had.
We'll hear more from him a bit later on. But first, to understand how ocular gene therapies work, I'm joined by Omar Maru, a consultant ophthalmologist at Moorfields and St Thomas's Hospitals. Omar is also a professor of retinal neuroscience at University College London. Well, Omar, thank you very much for joining me.
Great to join you.
So just to kick off, can you tell me what a gene is?
Sure, yeah. So a gene's a section of our DNA that contains instructions for making a protein. We've got about 20,000 different genes, and many of them have specific functions in the eye. We've got two copies of most of our genes, one from mum, one from dad. And in the context of genetic disease, there's usually a rare change, what we might call a spelling mistake, in one or both copies of the gene, and that leads to disease. And if we take genetic eye disease, of which a big component is inherited retinal disease, rare changes in any one of over 200 genes can lead to disease.
So what is gene therapy then?
Gene therapy at its simplest is where we try to replace the faulty gene with a healthy copy. Strictly, that's called gene replacement therapy. There are other types of gene therapy being investigated, such as sort of silencing abnormal genes or trying to edit genes. But these are in more preliminary stages. The more advanced stuff and the treatment that's available for one particular disease is a gene replacement therapy. There are also trials underway to investigate whether gene therapy might help in conditions that aren't down to problems in a single gene. So, for example, in AMD, people are investigating gene therapy to try and get the eye to produce, say, lots of anti-VEGF so that patients might not need repeated injections. So sometimes it's not necessarily replacing a faulty gene, but adding a gene that might help.
What happens when gene therapy is actually injected into the eye? How does the body react?
Yeah, it's a good question. So the gene therapy can be injected in different ways, but the one that's available for one particular rare disease is injected under the retina. So it's vitreoretinal surgeons who raise a bleb under the retina and they inject, and the gene is packaged in a virus vector, what we call a virus vector, to sort of protect the gene and get it into the retina. It's a virus that doesn't cause disease, but it helps get the gene into the retina. And, you know, when you're injecting some new genetic material, a question people wonder about is, why doesn't the body's immune system reject it? And sometimes it can. So the particular type of virus is chosen so it doesn't generate much of an immune reaction. The eye is what we call an immune privileged site. So compared to other parts of the body, the eye can sometimes tolerate foreign material more than other organs in the body. But often steroids are used to try and damp down the immune system to stop the body rejecting the gene therapy.
And does the therapy ever need to be repeated?
The hope is that it won't need to be repeated because the cellular machinery will still keep using that gene to produce the right protein. The hope is that it's a one-off treatment, but we don't know for sure. And we've got several years of follow-up for some of the early gene therapies, and it seems to have a lasting effect. But we don't know whether in the very long term it would need repeating or what's going to happen.
And that effect, the effect of that gene therapy, is it localized to just the eye that's been injected?
So the idea is that it would work locally and it shouldn't affect any other parts of the body. There was this interesting study where one of the diseases where gene therapy is being trialed is an optic nerve disease, Leber's hereditary optic neuropathy. And there they would inject one eye and they seemed to see an improvement in the other eye as well that wasn't injected. And so there's different explanations, but one possibility is that the gene therapy is moving to the other eye through the optic nerve because the optic nerve goes out and then they sort of meet at the chiasm. We don't know for sure, but that's one possibility.
And what sort of outcomes do you think we can expect from ocular gene therapy going forwards?
Yeah, so the great hope is that we can improve people's vision. And certainly in the gene therapy that's been licensed for this rare disease, RPE65 associated Leber's congenital amaurosis, those patients, their function in dim light, they saw an improvement. Or we might be just looking for a slowing of the disease or stopping the disease. So many of these diseases, most of them are progressive. Some of them progress to complete blindness. So even if you could slow that down or stop it, that would be great. And one thing is that there have to be surviving cells, say photoreceptors, that haven't died away because they're going to express the gene. So one of the criteria for gene therapy to work is that there should be some surviving cells. And those patients where, unfortunately, all the cells have died away, then other approaches need to be looked at. And it's unlikely that the usual gene replacement therapy would work.
And you've mentioned that typically steroids are given to dampen down the immune response. Are there any other side effects that we need to be aware of?
Yeah, so you say inflammation's a big thing and steroids are usually given for that. Something we've seen in Luxturna, which is this licensed gene therapy for RPE65 associated diseases, some patients have developed atrophy of the retina. Sometimes it's just at the injection site and it's not really affecting the center, the fovea, but some patients have even developed atrophy in the center. So most patients seem to have had an improvement, but some patients things got worse. And overall, different studies say different things, but maybe about 14% of patients might develop some retinal atrophy, but it is something that causes a bit of concern, and we're not still quite sure why some people develop it and others don't. Is it something to do with the patient themselves rather than the gene therapy, or would a different dose be better? So these things are being explored.
Are there any other effects that we need to be aware of outside of the eye?
So not really known at the moment. It seems to be safe. People did wonder because you're injecting foreign material. And certainly with other earlier gene therapy studies for other diseases, there were kind of systemic side effects. But for this, we don't seem to be seeing that. Obviously, putting people on steroids, that can affect you systemically and people can have side effects of that.
So, Omar, thinking about eye conditions that we might come across in practice, which are the ones that are being explored for gene therapy?
So one thing that's important to, I guess, explain to patients is that the vast majority of genetic eye disease, there isn't a gene therapy available now, even in trial phase, but we hope there will be in the future. But there's a licensed gene therapy now for Leber's congenital amaurosis or early onset severe retinal dystrophy due to changes in the RPE65 gene. So this is still a very rare cause of something that's very rare anyway, but it's something that you'd never want to miss. So any kids with early onset genetic retinal disease, then they should really be referred. Again, managing expectations, the chances are they don't have disease due to RPE65, but they might, and you definitely wouldn't want to miss them because those are the people who, the earlier you give them the gene therapy, the more likely they'll have a better result throughout their lives. Other conditions where trials are going on are X-linked retinitis pigmentosa. Those results are quite promising. Achromatopsia, early results didn't show much of an improvement, but there are ongoing trials. Maybe treating earlier is going to be helpful. Leber's hereditary optic neuropathy, we mentioned before, that's gene therapy trials are going on for that. And as we said before, so even for AMD, there are some gene therapy trials going on, so not just single gene disorders.
And is there a resource that optometrists go to find out what conditions are currently being investigated and are included in trials, just so they can find out more about it and possibly think about informing patients about these trials if they come across these conditions?
as with lots of things, unfortunately, there's no one place where you can get everything. But there is a website called clinicaltrials.gov, which is hosted in the US, and it has lots of clinical trials all over the world that have been registered on that website. It doesn't tell you that they're necessarily very good clinical trials, but they're just registered there. And so if you have a patient who knows their genetic diagnosis, you could type in that gene and see if there's anything happening anywhere in the world. There's a website called Gene Vision, which tells you about the genetic eye services across the UK. But we'd probably advise if someone has suspected genetic eye disease, it's worth them being referred just to be assessed in the hospital. Or we have clinics dedicated to inherited retinal disease at Moorfields Eye Hospital, but there'll also be more local centres as well in other parts of the UK. Because often these patients were seen years ago and discharged, there's nothing we can do for you. Although it's still true that for the majority, there's no treatment, but things have still moved on in trying to, for example, establish the genetic diagnosis, work out which gene is at play. So one, it can determine whether they're eligible for a trial. There are other reasons to try and establish the genetic diagnosis. Patients often want to know, what's the risk of my children being affected? And we can't really know that until we've got the gene. And sometimes, you know, making it clear that there's a genetic cause to their disease. We've got other patients who've been managed as query uveitis, so they're on immunosuppression, and it turns out they've got a genetic disease. So although we can't treat them, we at least say you can stop all of that immunosuppression that maybe had side effects because you don't need it. Still in 40% of our patients, we can't get a genetic diagnosis because those genes maybe haven't been discovered yet as being associated with eye disease, or the changes are really hard to find. So the other thing is we'd say is always manage expectations.
Yes, because in practice, we would ask patients about their family histories, any family history of eye disease, for example. And someone might say, oh, well, so-and-so had macular degeneration at an early age. Yes. Or, you know, my cousin has retinitis pigmentosa. And so when you come across those patients and they may be asymptomatic, at what point do we decide actually the patient should be referred? And also, where do we refer them to?
So I think if there are signs and there is any query that this patient may have a genetic disease, and often it's a young patient, like you say, it might look like age-related macular degeneration, but someone really young. And if there is a family history, these are things that could give you clues. If there's problems with the night vision, even if you're not seeing any signs in the retina, I think all of those, it's worth referring. Patient who's got absolutely nothing wrong in terms of symptoms or signs, but there's a family history, I suppose that often there isn't an urgency to refer them. But sometimes the patient are of childbearing age and they want to know. And it is true that you can be carrying a disease-associated gene that doesn't really manifest in you, but might potentially in your children. So if there is a family history and they want to be seen, then it probably does make sense to refer them. We sometimes have more advanced imaging perhaps than is available in many optometry practices. We can do a ultra wide field autofluorescence image. Sometimes that reveals things that you can't see clinically or on a normal OCT. So be happy to see patients if they wanted. And again, managing their expectations, there may be nothing that comes of this visit. Just get looked at thoroughly and have a chat. Be happy to see them in a routine way if they want to be. And sometimes you're not sure, but there are some signs like carriers for X-linked retinitis pigmentosa. They may have no symptoms, but they have this kind of shiny looking retina, this thing we call a tapetal reflex. And again, that may be relevant to them because they may have family members or they may be going to have children in the future. And so they might want to know, am I carrying the X-linked retinitis pigmentosa gene? So if I were to have a son, there'd be a 50-50 chance that they would be affected.
Are there actually any trials in the UK for conditions that are currently recruiting patients? And, you know, how can optometrists find out about these trials?
Yeah, a lot of these trials will require a genetic diagnosis, which patients may not be able to get until they get referred to the hospital. So I would probably refer them anyway.
Just to the local medical retina service?
I think probably to start with their local medical retina service, absolutely. And then they can look at them in a bit more detail. And then if they want to refer them, there's usually centres elsewhere in the UK as well that are very specialised in inherited eye disease. And there are also clinical genetics departments who can look into genetic testing, although now that can even be done from the eye department. Or they can refer on to Moorfields, where we're based, and we do see many patients from other parts of the country, and we'd be happy to see them. And in terms of what gene therapy trials there are, so one is the treatment Luxturna, so we never want to miss RP65. That usually affects children, so if someone's got disease onset in adulthood, they're much less likely to have that. But things like X-linked retinitis pigmentosa, there's a gene therapy trial going on at the moment, and that's quite a, you know, as far as rare inherited retinal disease goes, that's quite a common cause of inherited retinal disease. Achromatopsia, there are some gene therapy trials, and then there are some much rarer but still quite devastating conditions where there are gene therapy trials going on that patients can be recruited to once they have a genetic diagnosis.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Sound Optometry with me, Michelle Hanratty. Every month, we explore the topics that matter the most to us optometrists. If you've got a topic that you'd like us to cover, or a particularly interesting case you'd like to share, email us. The address is podcast@docket.info, or use LinkedIn to message us here at Docket. Joining me now is Rob Henderson, who is a consultant paediatric ophthalmologist, a vitreoretinal surgeon at Great Ormond Street Hospital. Hello, Rob. Welcome to Sound Optometry.
Hi, Michelle.
So, Rob, we've just heard from Omar Maru, who's told us about the different ocular gene therapies that are being developed. And he mentioned Luxturna. What does that treat?
Luxturna is the first licensed ocular gene therapy for RPE65-related retinal dystrophy. It was first trialled, and in fact I was involved in some of the first trials back in 2004-2005, and it wasn't until 2019 that we finally got FDA and EMA license for the Spark Therapeutics version of the RPE65 gene therapy, and that is Luxturna, and that's now delivered across three sites in the UK: Moorfields, Great Ormond Street, as a sort of combined site for adults and children, and then Oxford and Manchester are the other two sites.
So who would be your typical patient? Is there one?
So the rules are you have to have two copies, both the one that you got from your mum, the one that you got from your dad, in the RPE65, and both of them have got to have a disease-associated mutation in them. And so there are certain limitations around who we can treat. So they have to have viable cells in the posterior pole. How do we determine that? In older patients, we do OCT scans, and that usually tells us whether they've got a minimum volume in the retina, whether there are any large patches of atrophy near to the centre, because we don't really like that. But as long as a patient's got some detectable vision and some viable retina in the macula, then they are considered eligible for treatment. And so I have treated anyone from, I think my youngest patient was 15 months. And I mean, the oldest I've treated is 20s, because I don't normally do many of the adults. My colleague Jim Bainbridge does the adults, and same is true in Manchester and Oxford. So as long as there's vision, or hope for vision, then we're happy to treat.
So how well does it work?
The results have been anything from moderately successful, in the sense that some of the older patients may detect a slight improvement in their low illuminance vision. One or two older patients who have very limited vision, I think, probably haven't seen a massive improvement, if I'm honest. The really dramatic responses have been in the youngest patients. So we've found that children treated at three and under, those are the kids whose visual acuity has actually started to really pick up. So, for example, the 15-month-old that I was telling you about, she has now got 0.4 logmar vision. In fact, I think she might even be a bit better than that the last time we saw her. It is remarkable. And the average at her age is 0.8, 0.9. That's not to say that they see normally, and I think it would be overly silly to try and pretend that their vision is normal. So overall, I think it's a treatment that stops the decline, and I think in the older patients that they're fairly realistic that they're not going to get a transformatory improvement. But if they can hold on to what they've got, then that is a win for them. And in the younger patients, we are hopeful, if we get in really young, that we can actually give them a pretty normal life.
Yeah. So as you say, even though a child doesn't have normal vision, they may have functional vision to a degree. So to be able to develop things like social interaction, their education, it just gives them so much more than they would have had.
That's right. And, you know, even those that I've been treating between the ages of 5 and 8, for example, I mean, one of the most lovely stories, I remember one of them, mum saying just about a month or two after I treated her, it was Guy Fawkes Night, and they saw fireworks for the first time. And a mum was like, oh, it was spectacular. And others that, you know, report seeing Christmas lights. It's little things like those little vignettes that you get from the parents, which clearly means so much for parents, because their children are now suddenly going, what's that thing? I mean, I've not seen that before. It's very rewarding. It's one of the few treatments that I can honestly think of where you are restoring function and giving something that a child or an adult has possibly never had, which is in medicine quite unusual, actually.
So, Rob, just thinking about optometrists and community practice, how would we go about identifying those who should be referred?
The core questions that you want to think in the back of your head whenever you come across a child or an adult who's complaining of symptoms that might be retinal dystrophy related. And so the sort of standard questions that I might ask are you struggling in the dark? And they look at you and, well, what do you mean? Well, can you find your way to a cinema seat? Or if you live in the countryside, can you see the stars at night? If you can't see the stars at night in the countryside, that generally probably means that you have nyctalopia. And then the flip side of that is that for patients with cone rod dystrophies, often they're photophobic. So going out into bright sunlight is really uncomfortable. For RPE65, there are a couple of other little sort of nuggets that you probably wouldn't necessarily know of. You ask mum and dad, do they like lights? And these kids just love light. I've had a child take my pen torch and yank it out of my hand and just, oh. I mean, they love them. They have true photo attraction, which is really quite uncommon, actually. There aren't that many inherited retinal diseases where you see really true, genuine photo attraction and profound night blindness as well. That's a very uncommon pair of symptoms. So I think if you encounter a child or an adult complaining of those sort of symptoms, that should certainly prick your ears up and go, ah, and then do the appropriate imaging, and they might do an OCT if they've got those in practice, and then refer in. So just being aware of retinal dystrophies, particularly in childhood, is super important.
And of course, not everybody lives near Moorfields or Manchester or Oxford, but we can refer to our local medical retina service, and the consultants there would filter the appropriate patients to send on.
Correct.
And is there a role for optometrists in supporting patients after they've had gene therapy?
Yes, I mean, one must never forget that refractions continue to be vitally important. And so often the gene therapy patients will have a fairly close follow-up for the first months and probably years, in truth. There are things that we hadn't ever anticipated and didn't necessarily recognise in the first trials. So, for example, this phenomenon known as outer retinal atrophy. It's not entirely clear exactly what's going on, but essentially what we see are patches of RPE and ellipsoid photoreceptor loss. And those can be either around the edge of the bleb or, and indeed I've had this once, under the fovea. And occasionally they're outside the area of the bleb. So monitoring for those signs, which usually appear within the first 6 months, is actually really important to us. And certainly being aware that if a patient has had gene therapy, looking for signs of inflammation would be hugely helpful, whether it's anterior chamber or vitreous cells. And if indeed for those practices that have some sort of fundus photography or OCT, looking for inflammatory signs in the retina would be extremely helpful. If you pick that up and send them straight back to us, I think we'd be incredibly grateful.
So I think for those of us in practice who aren't necessarily tied to a hospital eye service, it's important to have that awareness. If someone has had gene therapy, just what the potential risks in the short term afterwards are.
Correct. And at the moment, of course, you know, we're talking about conditions that are super rare and you're almost certainly not going to be seeing these patients. But, and this is a big but, one of the biggest trials that we are currently waiting phase 3 data from, there are two trials for X-linked RP. Now, that's quite a lot more common. And then that is dwarfed potentially by the prospect of gene therapy for age-related macular degeneration. So if you have wet age-related macular degeneration, you're having monthly injections and it's horrendous, maybe you'd have a one-off treatment and suddenly you may now only need one injection or so top up occasionally a year, potentially transformatory. But the number of patients we're talking about is just terrifying. So suddenly we're going to be really reliant on having colleagues out there. You know, this concept of gene therapy is not some sort of dim and distant research thing. This is a real issue on a day-to-day basis. And I don't think that's that far away, potentially.
So phase 3 trials are on the way for AMD gene therapy treatments. If those trials go well and the drug is both safe and effective, when might we have it in practice?
That's the bazillion dollar question, really, because, of course, if you think about, we were doing the first phase 1-2 trial for RPE65 in 2004 to 2006. And it wasn't until 2018, 2019 that we get permission to go, and 2020 when the first patient's treated. So it can take a very long time. Now, I think those periods are shortening, but it's by no means a certainty that we would pay for it. There have been gene therapies that have been successful, but we have not paid for because we cannot make an agreement between the NHS and the company. And they ask for a lot of money. I mean, just to give you an example, the list price for Voretigene Neparvovec for RP65 is $816,000 for a pair of eyes. Now, we don't pay that. The NHS is very good, actually, at collective bargaining, the bargaining power it has, but it's still it's a lot of money. And so you can imagine that it won't take very many of these treatments for NICE and for the NHS to go, yeah, particularly for a condition as prevalent as AMD. And the cost of doing trials, as I know, is, you know, it's hundreds of millions. It's eye-watering, to be honest.
So there's still lots to resolve behind the scenes, and perhaps we should manage our expectations for the time being. And of course, we will be waiting quite some time for treatments, even if the pricing is worked out.
I think that's right. Not for a while yet. But I do think, I mean, I'm cautiously optimistic that prices will come down. They have to. Healthcare systems can't afford it. So I think there needs to be a readjustment.
It makes the cost of the original Novartis drug for wet AMD seem like pocket money in comparison, doesn't it?
Peanuts. Absolutely right.
Rob, thank you very much.
Very welcome. Lovely to talk to you.
It's clear that lots still needs to be resolved in healthcare systems, but there is reason for hope. To finish off, Omar Maru, the ophthalmologist we heard from earlier, also gave his thoughts for the future.
There are more and more gene therapy trials going on. And as we said, there's over 200 different genes that could be at play in inherited retinal disease. So that's one area. Some of the genes are quite big, like literally too big to fit into the virus vectors we use. So people need to look at other approaches. And then there are genes where the gene's kind of doing something bad and it's not enough to give more of the normal gene. You've got to try and silence the faulty gene. So people are looking at that. And as we said, gene therapy, even for non-monogenic diseases like AMD, maybe there'll be gene therapy for in the future. And then I think also for inherited retinal disease, it's probably unrealistic to think that every genetic disease will have its own gene therapy. There need to be approaches where, irrespective of the genetic cause, something's going to stop the disease getting worse or bring the vision back, or those patients who've lost all their photoreceptors, the gene therapy is not going to work. And people are looking at stem cells, optogenetics, to try and get the cells that are remaining, like the ganglion cells, trying to get them to respond to light, become light sensitive, electronic implants into the retina. There were some early promising results, then it stopped a bit. And now there are new companies in that space looking at modifiers, why similar genetic variants cause severe disease in one person, mild disease in another person. If we can work out what makes the mild guy mild, maybe we can make the severe guy mild. So these are the kind of areas of research at the moment.
Our thanks to Omar Maru and Rob Henderson, and thank you for listening. Don't forget that if you head to docket.info and search for sound optometry, you can find the additional reading materials and resources for this episode. And by listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on the website, you can gain one CPD point, covering communication and clinical practice. We'll be taking a month off, but the podcast will be back again in September, so make sure you hit subscribe on your podcast app so that you don't miss out. All of us on the sound optometry team hope you have a lovely summer. The producers are Jason Hoskin and Dr. Hilary Guite. I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thanks for listening.